Spirit Catholic Radio, KVSS. We are Catholic Radio for the Christian community. Good morning. Welcome to Spirit Mornings with Bruce McGregor and
Chris McGregor.
Joined today, Chris, by Dr. Matthew Bunsen. He is a senior fellow at the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, one of the United States' leading authorities on the papacy and the church as well. He's authored more than 30 books and since 1997 has served as general editor of our Sunday Visitor's Catholic Almanac, the largest compendium of facts and statistics on the Catholic Church. Dr. Bunsen has also served as a consultant to MSNBC, NBC News, CBS Radio, and the BBC, as well as other media outlets. Also special consultant on Catholic Affairs for USA Today during its coverage of the 2005 papal funeral and conclave. And we are delighted to be joined by him this morning. Dr. Bunsen, good morning and welcome back, I should say.
Good morning. It's always a great pleasure to be with you.
For many of our listeners, they just heard you yesterday on Catholic Answers because it was the anniversary of the death of John Paul II and your comments on that. And I guess for those who might have missed it in the morning, it was a remarkable thing that occurred just 2 years ago, isn't it?
Well, on the one hand, it's hard to imagine that 2 years have already passed.
Yeah.
The death of Pope John Paul II. On the other, it's been a remarkable 2 years observing the pontificate of Pope Benedict and also the immense spiritual progress of John Paul II's cause for canonization. There's obviously quite a bit of discussion right now about the French nun who may very well have been cured from Parkinson's. And if that's the case, then we could be looking at a very swift beatification for our late and truly beloved pontiff, who I think is well on his way, not only, as I have said before, to being declared a saint, but also a doctor of the church, and already the title that they give him of the Great.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's one of those moments where all of us can reflect back, and it was also one of those events in our lives that I think we can all remember where exactly we were when we heard the news that John Paul II had actually passed away.
Oh, we were talking about that on Monday, that I remember it was, of course, on a Saturday, and we all were holding vigil. It was a beautiful day here in this area, but everybody I know was glued to their television.
Yes, I was certainly, although I'm embarrassed to say that I was on the phone when the word actually arrived with a reporter. So it was an odd experience for me. But it was a touching one as well, because the reporter, as I recall, who was not even Catholic, had to hang up and ask to call me back because he found the whole experience so emotionally powerful that he couldn't carry on for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was right there crystallized so wonderfully the spiritual, emotional, and religious power of John Paul II. He was a truly transcendent figure whose work, whose legacy, and whose greatness, I think, reached across every possible divide in the world.
Mm. Yeah, certainly when you talk about saints among us, we had one, praise God, with us for many, many years, and of course many decades, as our pontiff, so, wow.
And I think we're going to be looking at decades to come of trying to understand fully his influence, the depth of his own spirituality, and, of course, trying to implement and appreciate more fully the legacy of his theology, of his writings, and his very prophetic warnings for the modern world and where it's headed in so many different directions.
It's truly a time for us to really reflect, and, of course, Holy Week is a great time for that as well. And that's one of the reasons why we love talking to you so much, Dr. Bunsen, because you have given to many of us through your work with the Catholic Almanac, but also in all your other books, all the tremendous writings that you have, helped us not to forget our ancestors of faith or the richness of our tradition. So we really thank you for that.
Well, it's a genuine privilege for me to be able to work on a lot of these projects. The Encyclopedia of Church History, for example, and then the upcoming, we were actually managed to finish it, the upcoming Encyclopedia of American Catholic History for
wow.
Sunday Visitor, which is at this point pushing the envelope of, in length of even the original Encyclopedia of Catholic History. I think the manuscript, when it's finished, will be close to 3,000 pages.
Wow.
And I don't say that to impress people. I say that because that gives a small way of expressing the depth of American Catholic history and how, at times, underappreciated it has been.
Well, and really had to overcome a lot of patent anti-Catholic bias.
Oh, exactly. The sufferings of Catholics throughout American history is not something that can be underestimated, and it's not something that I think we can forget, because we're seeing today the same kinds of anti-Catholicism that we saw based on ignorance and hatred for what the Church has to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And anti-Catholicism comes in many guises, it comes in many forms and many shapes, but it's always consistent in opposing the truth of what the Church has to offer to the world.
Right.
And one of the things that a study of American Catholic history can teach us is the way that courage, confidence, and fortitude will in the end win out, because the truth is the truth, regardless of whether people want to hear it or not.
Oh, okay. Amen to that.
Yes.
And I'm so thankful to have you here now so that we can look at just some of those lives, the Catholic heroes of early America. For all those people who in the surrounding and our listening audience, probably, how many, Bruce, at least in the Archdiocese of Omaha and I think the Diocese of Lincoln, probably well over 1,000 people will be coming into full communion to the Roman Catholic Church. And we owe it to them, as those who have knowledge or were passing on the faith, to help them to learn the great legacy they've joined themselves to.
I would absolutely agree. The two things that are worth mentioning in my mind, the first is that in the wake of the much discussed and I think at times overanalyzed sex abuse scandal of the last 5-6 years,
mm-hmm.
we have not seen statistically a major drop-off in new converts to the Church.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that truly remarkable.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, that is something.
Told me that, that, again, we go back to the truth that the Church has to offer is something that transcends, that goes past, and is much more visible than the horrendous mistakes of some of the Church's members.
Mm-hmm.
We could include in that, of course, the 4% of the clergy who actually were involved in various forms of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
That's a statistic that I think is worth repeating. 4%
right.
All of the Catholic priests in the last 50-some-odd years were involved in sexual abuse of some kind. And the 96% deserve our love and our support and our encouragement and our celebration, too. And that's something else I think that a lot of people grasp intuitively, that we can talk about some of these cases of abuse, of failure on the part of the Church's members, but the Church remains what it is for the world, a sacrament, a sign of eternal life, and a sign of hope, and a sign of the kind of personal happiness, personal fulfillment that people all over the world are searching for.
Mm.
And every year, by the hundreds of thousands, people come into the Church because of that. And that's worth noting. I think that's worth celebrating. The other thing that we can point out is that there has long been discussion that in the days after Vatican II, somehow everything that went before the Second Vatican Council wasn't important anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And the study of Church history, the study of American Church history, reminds us that we can't forget the past. We have to celebrate the past, because there was not one Church Council. There have been 21 great ecumenical councils.
Mm-hmm.
And the Second Vatican Council built on the magnificent edifice of the council that went before it. And that's something, too, I think that people can understand, something they can appreciate. And our job is to celebrate, not just celebrating the past, but understanding how we have come to where we are today.
When you look at the legacy in America, once again, you have the story of priests who, in many cases, sacrificed their own lives to be able to bring that message of the hope that's found in the Church. And I think one of those, you know, the very first, the proto-martyr of the United States, the first to be killed for the faith was a Franciscan father, Juan de Padilla.
Yes.
What was his story?
Well, as was often the case, and in fact it was almost always the case, and it's hard for us to consider that today, it was the custom of the times when the great project of evangelizing the new world started, not to send the men and women that were considered disposable, or people that, well, if something happened to them on the frontier, it wouldn't be a great loss to the church or the quite the opposite. They sent the best and the brightest. They sent to the new world men and women, Jesuit priests, Franciscan priests, who had doctorates in theology, who had doctorates in canon law, who were experts in philosophy and church history. And they're the ones who were filled with the missionary zeal, and as is so often the case, they're the ones who also died for the faith. Mm. So rather than thinking of it as a tragic loss of theologians and canon lawyers, the Jesuits and the Franciscans saw this as the offering for the betterment of the church and for the salvation of souls, the best we had to offer. And that was really the case with Juan Padilla, who was a gifted Franciscan priest who arrived in the New World, eager to preach. And he traveled with the different Spanish conquistadors and Spanish exploratory groups and preached to the local Native Americans. And in 1542, in Kansas, he was the first priest to be killed, and hence we call him and honor him as the proto-martyr, or the first martyr of the United States, emulating St. Stephen, who was honored as the proto-martyr of the church, the first person to die for professing the faith.
And those, not only Franciscans, but of course the sacrifice of the Jesuits.
Exactly, and they're especially known for their work in the northern parts of North America, in what would now be Canada, in the Great Lakes areas, in New York and elsewhere. And just a few that were discussed in a recent article that I had the pleasure of working on for our Sunday Visitor. One was, for example, Father Pierre Bayoquette, who was born in 1612, and who gave almost his entire life to caring for the missions and the Native Americans in the area around present-day Illinois and throughout the Lakes area, and for caring for victims of deadly epidemics and Indian settlements, and, as I said, literally giving his life to proclaim the gospel in what was then a very harsh wilderness. Mm-hmm. And in the end, he died among the Ottawa Indians, remembering 1692, and he was beloved by them, in much the same way that another Jesuit missionary, Father Sebastian Raleigh, who served among the Abenakis in Maine, and it would be modern Maine, in the early 18th century. The same kind of commitment, the same mission. And these were priests who faced death on a regular basis from Native Americans who did not like missionaries or who were allies of the English. They also faced arrest and imprisonment at the hands of the British, who, of course, at that period of history, had very strong rules against the Catholic Church in England and also in the colonies. Death from all kinds of directions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the role of the British on putting prices on the heads of these priests that ran these missions, I think we forget about that.
Yes.
Kind of a major footnote to overlook.
And that's a consistent problem that the missionaries had to cope with and Catholics had to cope with all the time. And if we're thinking also of the remarkable women during the same period, I'm reminded of the great Margaret Brent, who in the colony of Maryland was the first woman in Maryland to own land and to conduct business ventures as a single woman, but who also became a strong voice for the rights of Catholics in the colonies. And this is during a period of enormous upheaval, because it's easy to forget that Maryland, which was founded as a haven for Catholics, was handed over into the hands of the Puritans and then the forces of Oliver Cromwell, who is probably most famous in history for orchestrating and overseeing the beheading of King Charles II and the imposition of what was really a dictatorship over England, both political and religious. And the terrible persecution of the church in Ireland and then in the colonies.
Yeah.
So someone like Margaret Brent, who suffered from the two defects of the period of being Catholic and also being a woman, I think, stands out as another one of those role models, and we owe it to her to remember her name as well.
Yeah, you bet. Well, as you point out, too, Dr. Bunsen, I mean, the Protestant magistrates who were really kind of in control of things, well, they had a deep, abiding respect for Margaret and her accomplishments and everything else. Really, the fact that she was Catholic was like negated all of that, and she ultimately had to leave Maryland, didn't she?
Yes, she did, and that's a consistent problem that Catholics faced. And as we move forward in American history, when we're looking at the role of Catholics in the subsequent American Revolution, it's interesting to think that Catholics who were willing to give their lives for the freedom, the declaration of American freedom from England, yes, on the one hand, they had a lot to fight for because they were fighting for a new country. They were fighting for independence from a country that had tormented, arrested, tortured, and very often killed people that they knew or they themselves had endured severe legal disabilities as Catholics. But at the same time, they were facing equal hostility from their fellow Americans.
Mm-hmm.
We consider that the Catholic faith was outlawed in many of the colonies, that many of the state legislatures had test oaths that they imposed on Catholics, that somehow Catholics were second-class citizens if they were tolerated at all. There were a lot of great uncertainties, I think, for Catholics in fighting the English in the American Revolution,
mm-hmm.
because they weren't really quite certain where things were going to go once America gained its independence. But it's a statement, I think, of the brilliance and the courage and the dedication of Catholics in fighting in the war, such as Sure Shot Tim Murphy,
yeah.
mm-hmm.
who was a noted American sniper and rifleman, and his own wife, Peggy Murphy, who helped in her own way with the war effort. All of them were justified in saying at the end of the war, all right, we gave our lives, we spilled our blood for you. Are we not entitled to the same rights and privileges as every other American?
Yeah.
And their example, I think, made it impossible for the anti-Catholics to continue the kinds of persecutions and disabilities that had been in existence under the British rule. And I think it was a great moment, not just for Catholics, but also for the country, that recognition was finally made.
When I went to Washington and was able to go to the archives, and they had just redone the area where they had the exhibits for the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, when I got to the Declaration of Independence, I wasn't looking for John Hancock. I was looking for Charles Carroll.
Right.
Because I think that was probably out of all of my... No, John Hancock wrote big so that, you know, everyone would know that he was... The story, I think it is that he was not ashamed of having his name on there. But Charles Carroll, I think, that did the braver thing.
Yes, he did. And one of the fun stories that we were able to put in that particular article was that he wrote his signature Charles Carroll of Carrollton. And when the various other signers asked why it was that he signed Charles Carroll of Carrollton, he said so that the King George would know which of the Carrolls to hunt down, because there were a number of very prominent ones, Daniel Carroll and, of course, his magnificent brother John Carroll,
right.
mm-hmm.
relative John Carroll, who was, of course, the first bishop of the United States and then also the first archbishop in the United States. He has the distinction also of putting his immense wealth on the line for the American cause of independence. And then also has the distinction of being the last survivor of the signers of the Declaration of Independence.
Mm.
So this is someone, I think, who understood more than even someone like Sure Shot Tim Murphy what he had to lose should the cause of American independence fail. And it was, I think, an act of genuine courage on his part to act as he did. But also, I think it was a certain trust that real change was possible if the faith can be held authentically and if the nerve and the confidence of Catholics can be maintained.
Right. Of course, he was very proactive in being outspoken about the fact that let's get this revolution going.
<You know? laughs> Right. But he was also someone who, in the period before the American Revolution, was active in Catholic apologetics. with his various newspaper columns.
That's right.
Yep.
He signed First Citizen, and he took on a lot of the anti-Catholics of the period. And that was another, I think, demonstration of the kind of courage and optimism that they had, that, all right, this is something that our anti-Catholic Protestant opponents want to put out there, but we also have a right in the kind of society that we want to build to reply to that. And that anticipated a lot of the great apologetics work of Archbishop John Carroll, and then, of course, other Catholic apologists, such as the Reverend Prince Demetrius Gallitzin, who spent 40 years in the Allegheny Mountains in western Pennsylvania, replying also to Protestant attacks, and doing so with books and pamphlets and speeches with such fearlessness that his life was in danger on a number of occasions.
I don't think very many people know, if you were to ask them who was the father of the American Navy, I think the most prominent is John Paul Jones, but it wasn't. It was an Irish Catholic.
Yes, Commodore John Barry, another one of those unsung heroes. And as you say, everyone knows John Paul Jones,
mm-hmm.
if for no other reason than the number of bad movies that have been made about him. But
that's
with
true.
Barry, we have someone who's actually technically outranked John Paul Jones, because if you look at the appointments of the officers made by George Washington and then approved, I think, by the United States Senate, John Barry was given the rank of or registration of number one
mm-hmm.
for all of the captains of the United States Navy. And this is someone who, again, was a talented officer, talented sailor, who recognized that there was a real opportunity here, not just for Catholics, but for people of enterprise, people of courage, and people of ambition in what was a very young republic. And he, like a lot of other people, put a lot on the line, including his life in combat and in society.
I think that's the key when you think about such a very young nation and from areas that were considered second-class areas in Europe, those who would emigrate over here. And Ireland, of course, was considered that. I mean, they were so crushed by the British and caused to be so subservient to England that a lot of their emigrants came here and did such remarkable things for the country. And, of course, I'm thinking of Margaret Gaffney.
Mm-hmm.
What a role so many of them played in just being servants to the poor, to the city, living out their faith.
Right. And it's the thing that's most interesting about our Margaret, as she was called, Margaret Gaffney Howery, in New Orleans in around the middle of the 19th century, is that she didn't do things with an aim for fame or power or money. She did things because she looked around the city of New Orleans that she loved and saw that people were in need.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, it was an act of charity. It was a commitment on her part to what the church teaches and what we're called to do by Christ that earned her the lasting historical fame that she has. And we think of her work with the yellow fever epidemics that struck New Orleans, in which she literally went house to house to care for the victims of the yellow fever, and then made the unbelievable promise to mothers who were dying from the yellow fever, that if their children survived, she would somehow find a way to look out for them.
Mm.
And it was from that horrific beginning, even though that she was alone, she had seemingly very few skills, that she began from her own wages an orphanage, the famed female orphan asylum, yeah. The Sisters of Charity, that it started, I think, in 1840. And how she managed every day to keep this orphan place going through her own bakery, through her work delivering the milk from a dairy. All of those things were a reflection of her commitment to the Catholic faith. But one of the things that I like to think about, especially with someone like her, is that here was someone who got up every day and worked literally for the entire day with mm-hmm. one purpose, of taking care of the young children who had been put in her care, whom she had volunteered to care for the simple reason that she believed this was something that God was asking her to do.
Mm.
And that's edifying, I think, for anyone of any age, any period of history to think about. And at her death, the people of New Orleans, who again called her Our Margaret, honored her and decided to raise a monument in her honor. And I think it was in 1884, a little park called Margaret Place, that the statue, and as I understand it, it's still there today.
She's just a shining example of someone who, in her own suffering in that Paschal mystery, that was the death of not only her husband but her baby, turned that around and went and helped those who suffered and right. learned from that and grew from that.
And it's the ceaseless effort to be transformed by grace and to respond to grace. And in one of the things, and I'm sure that you see this all the time yourselves, as you travel, as you meet people, you have on the radio show on a regular basis, I know, remarkable theologians who can explain in enormous detail all of the virtues, the theological and cardinal virtues, who perhaps have written doctoral dissertations on the virtues, on the spiritual life. Someone like Our Margaret might not have been able to explain the theological virtues, hope, faith, and love, but she lived them every day, and she exemplified them every day. And that's, in a way, a more lasting and powerful example than all of the dissertations that have ever been written.
Right. That was beautifully said, Matthew, because you look back and you see those who have brought us such important messages, whether it is Thérèse of Lisieux, who became a doctor of the church, or even Sister Faustina, I mean, who only completed a few years of school.
Right.
Here are people that brought us a message. Ordinary people are bringing us extraordinary things, and that's really grace, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And that's an authenticity of faith that can't be underestimated. And that is also the authenticity of faith that is able to transform culture and to renew culture. And it's why when people ask if I'm optimistic about the future, even in a seemingly increasingly barren, arid spiritual land, like some would say the United States is, I'm optimistic because there are today a lot of Our Margarets out there. There are today a lot of Juan Padillas out there, and they are waiting to proclaim the gospel in their own way. They're waiting to live the gospel, and or they do so right now, unheralded, but they are slowly and magnificently changing people's lives in ways that we don't see, but in ways that God sees and that the church one day, I think, will celebrate.
Praise God that we have you to be able to give us their stories and to help us to be able to see that with those beautiful lenses of faith. We thank you so much for everything that you do for us. And I'm looking forward to that big book. I got to call up our Sunday visitor right away and tell them to put me on that list for the very first ones that get out.
Well, if God willing, then the book will be done in the near future, and then we'll be out as quickly as we can get it out.
Well, and we do want to encourage everyone, of course, to keep up with Dr. Bunsen's articles in our Sunday Visitor.
That's right. Just visit the website and you can get the archives of two outstanding articles that appeared in the month of March. Just go back and look at the back issues and look up. Just put Dr. Bunsen's name in and you'll find The Catholic Heroes of Early America and Pioneering Women of Faith. And
I appreciate very much the fact that our Sunday Visitor has a great sense of Catholic heritage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They're doing their part to celebrate it.
Yeah. Well, and like I said, we've barely scratched the surface of people that Dr. Bunsen pulled up to report on in the course of these articles. And one of the other things is we began talking at the beginning of this segment about the wonderful transparency of our late Holy Father John Paul II and everything else, and how through his works and through his life and his prayer, he really had a deep effect on not only Catholics, but many of our Protestant brothers and sisters as well. Certainly a lot of these early martyrs here in the Catholic Church in America certainly did. I love just a little aside on George Washington wanting to get rallying support from some of the Indians, and they said, fine, we'll throw in with you, but first send us a black robe. you know, that they had these names. They simply called the Jesuits and the Franciscans that were among them black robes, because they really lived their faith. They really lived the works. I mean, for those of you who don't think that works are necessary,
there are expressions of the faith that we hold in our hearts.
Many, many remarkable people have been chronicled here in these articles. So, again, Dr. Bunsen, we appreciate your being with us today. Thank you so very much, and we look forward to our next conversation.
Well, thank you so much for having me, as always. It's a great privilege to be on, and don't underestimate the important work that you're doing on a daily basis.
Well, thank you, Dr. Bunsen. Any final thoughts approaching the Triduum?
This is a moment, I think, for Catholics and for all people of faith to remember what it is that happened over these days, and that, as we've been discussing, your lives can be changed if you accept the grace and embrace the faith fully with an open mind and open heart, and allow yourself to be transformed by the power of grace.
Well, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, thank you so much for giving us a little of that transforming grace here this morning and spending time with us. We deeply appreciate it.
Thank you again, and God bless.